my hope to this morning to just work right through the whole psalm, starting at the beginning and down through the last verse, and draw some points of application and conclusion. So I want to read the words first, and then we'll take a look at the text on a verse-by-verse basis. To the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of David. I said, I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle, while the wicked are before me. I was mute with silence. I held my peace even from good, and my sorrow was stirred up. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue. Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am. Indeed, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my age is as nothing before you. Certainly every man at his best state is but vapor. Selah. Surely every man walks about like a shadow. Surely they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches and does not know who will gather them. And now, Lord, what do I wait for? My hope is in you. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Do not make me the reproach of the foolish. I was mute. I did not open my mouth because it was you who did it. Remove your plague from me. I am consumed by the blow of your hand. When with rebukes you correct man for iniquity, you make his beauty melt away like a moth. Surely every man is vapor. Selah. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner, as all my fathers were. Remove your gaze from me, that I may regain strength, before I go away and am no more. And it's my earnest prayer that God will bless the reading, the preaching, especially the hearing of His Word. Well, David's psalm provides us an inside look at someone who has learned to see God's gaze. I hope to answer why that is so important for us today in this sermon. David wrote this psalm many years ago, obviously, and gave it to Jeduthun so that it could be sung in worship. It's noteworthy, I think, that he would do such an act, for it's not a very flattering picture toward David. It doesn't paint him in a promising light. Yet the Holy Spirit inspired these words that David recorded for us, that we might sing them together, that we might meditate on them, and we might feel the pinch that David was in when similar circumstances occur and our life, to the end that we might order our affairs better than what David did, especially at the beginning. So let's take a look and see what happened to David. In verse 1 he said, I will guard my ways lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle while the wicked are before me. Now, sometimes as we read the Psalms, we find there are people or there are occasions mentioned, either perhaps in the title or throughout the text, to help us place this Psalm or these events somewhere in the chronology of David's life. And in this Psalm, we find no such information. We don't know when it occurred. We don't know who was involved in these troubles that David had. We have really no specific circumstances in this song to help us understand when and where it occurred in David's life. The only clue, in fact, we're given is in this first verse where David says, when the wicked are before me. The wicked are before me. Now, this might mean that perhaps these people, the wicked, whoever they might be, Perhaps they held influence over David or the country of Israel as a whole. Perhaps they had some political influence or power, or perhaps some military influence or economic power over which they were exercising their dominion. Either way, we don't know exactly what was happening, but we do see what it was doing within David. And it was producing grief and frustration and temptation as well. And you might think, well, isn't David a great king? I mean, don't kings always get what they want? I mean, somebody who is as powerful as David, surely he could dispatch with the wicked and make his problems go away. Well, kings often get many things they like, but they don't always get everything they want. David certainly had many different occasions in his life where his plans were brought to a frustrating point. In fact, it appears he had trouble governing even his own house, where his son would rise in rebellion against him. Additionally, we don't know whether these events occurred when David was king. Perhaps they occurred when he was a shepherd, or maybe they occurred when he was a fugitive on the run from Saul. Or maybe they did occur when he was king. We don't know. But we do know that David, like us, wants a peaceful life. Nobody wants to be dominated by the wicked. Nobody wants to be prevailed upon by the ungodly. No one, especially those who have been born again, want to see the wicked prosper in such a way that they bring distress to the righteous. David life in many ways, whether he was a king or whether he was a shepherd, is no different than you or I. We want the same thing, right? We want a peaceful life. We want to coexist with our neighbors. We want to see God's righteousness vindicated, and we want to see the wicked punished. And even though we don't know the details, we do know that these troubles are real. When the wicked were set before him, David realized that he was brought to a point in his frustration that he was tempted to sin. And he did not want that to happen. So he said, I will put a guard on all of my ways. I will hedge my ways so that I cannot be made to sin. And in the classic forms of Hebrew poetry, he wants to draw our attention to the repetition that this idea is enforced because it's repeated. I will guard my ways. I will put a muzzle on my mouth. Why would you put a muzzle on your mouth? Well, it's to restrain your speech in some capacity. Why? Because David didn't want to say anything that he would regret. He didn't want to sin with his mouth. You've got to take drastic measures when in your time of frustration, when the circumstances prevailing upon you are so difficult that you feel to even open your mouth would be an invitation to sin. And so you decide, I don't want to do that. I don't want to sin. I'll keep my mouth shut. Generally speaking, it's pretty good advice. If you feel inclined to say something stupid, or inclined to say something that you will regret, or that would defame or slander another person or God, then by all means, keep your mouth shut. Do not sin in so speaking. It's good reason why people don't say things under difficult circumstances. But as we find in verse 2, the problem didn't go away. David wasn't delivered from his trouble. He says, I was mute with silence. I held my peace even from good, and my sorrow was stirred up within me. My heart was hot. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue. He wasn't just silent. He describes himself as mute. He's already repeated this idea of the restraint he had imposed upon himself. And now he wants to reinforce this idea to show how hard he was striving against sin. I was mute with silence. I wouldn't even speak for good. So when the occasion came for David to speak for ill and sin, or to speak something for good? He said, I was mute. I didn't say a thing. You couldn't pry the words out of my mouth. I didn't utter anything in this circumstance. I was quiet. I did not sin with my mouth. That's real conviction, isn't it? To work that hard to avoid sinful words. David says, I didn't say a thing. When you look at the account of the words spoken in this event, you'll not find that I've said anything at all. But David, what about the times when maybe you should have said something, when you could have spoken for good? I was mute with silence. So concerned was I that I didn't say a thing. That's some serious commitment to not using your tongue for evil. Hold your tongue. Hold it. It is pretty good advice, isn't it? But it doesn't always lead to a good outcome. You see, David was silent on the outside, but he was hardly silent on the inside. The words weren't coming out of his mouth, but the words were in his heart. The trouble was already brewing, and the more the situation was made aware to him, the more thought he put into the situation, the less contained he found himself on the inside. Oh, the muzzle was working. He wasn't using his words. But look at the imagery that he evokes by what was happening as he thought about the situation. My sorrow was stirred up. My heart was hot within me. And while I was musing, the fire burned. This is not someone who is quiet on the inside, is it? This is someone who is boiling. Now, if you put a pot on a stove and you fill it with water and you turn up the heat, well, it just boils, right? What happens when you put a lid on top of it? Well, that pressure builds up on the inside, and the lid might even begin to move and jump around a little bit until finally the pressure gets high enough that something has to give. David is in a world of hurt on the inside. The more he thought about this, the more tumultuous his life became on the inside. Yes, he restrained from speaking, but there came a point when he couldn't take it anymore. It was then, he said, that I spoke with my tongue. Finally, the time has come for David. The pressure is too much. The wicked are prevailing. The unrighteousness around him is more than he can handle. He has not said anything till this time. I've kept my peace. But on the inside, he was a mess. On the inside, these pressures, this affliction, this difficulty, in whatever form it was taking, had so stirred him on the inside that he just couldn't take it anymore. It's then that he starts to utter some words, and we can find out what it was that he was thinking. In verse 4, he says, Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am. Indeed, you've made my days as handbreadths, and my age is as nothing before you. Certainly, every man at his best state is but vapor. Selah. It's good that when David did decide to speak, instead of going to his friend, or posting on Facebook, or sending out a text message to someone, he took it to Jehovah. He took it to God and said, I need to talk to you about this. My heart is in a terrible state. Just imagine the difficulties that would drive a man to do this. How unrighteous were the wicked acting at this time? How arrogant must they have been? David is angry now. And he wants to understand the root of the matter and when God will make it all right. And he asks God, He says, make me to know my end and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am. And in the opening of this prayer, the Spirit comes and He gives an answer to David. See, David's question, in a sense, boils down to, how long, O Lord? How long? How long am I going to be made to endure this calamity? How long must I feel this rejection, this abandonment, and the despair that you've placed me in? When will it end? When will the unrighteousness around me cease? When will I have strength? And just like that, the Spirit comes to David and gives him his first answer. He says, indeed, you've made my days as handbreadths. Now, a handbreadth isn't something we use much as a unit of measure anymore. Kids, you ever measure anything with a handbreadth? You know what a handbreadth is? You could take a handbreadth. It's from the bottom of your hand to the top of the finger here, not including the thumb. That's a handbreadth. And David says that, Lord, make me to know the end of my days. What is my measure? And God shows him, oh, David, you're just a few handbreadths. You're just a few fingers on top of a few fingers. That's all you are, David. The handbreadth. About 4 fingers worth of value. In other words, nearly nothing is what David understands. His age is as nothing before God. You see, it started off David thinking it was long, right? How long, O Lord? I've been enduring this for a while. I need to know what's the end of my days. And now he's thinking, wow, my life is so short. My life is nothing. My age is as nothing before you. And then in another moment of reflection, David realizes that it's not just him. He's not the only one with a short life, but that every person around him is as vapor. Vapor. Where do you get vapor? You see it on that pot that was boiling. You might see it off the top of a cup of coffee if it's nice and hot. You might see it come off of a little bit of smoke coming off a fire. Perhaps you light a match and you blow it out, then you see the smoke. How long do you see that smoke? Does it last a long time? No, it goes away. When you see the steam coming off a kettle, how long does it last? That long and it's gone. David's revelation here is, not only is my life so short you could measure it in a handbreadth, oh no, wait a minute, it says nothing, but that surely every person around, their life is like a vapor. Everyone's life, it's not just me. It's not just my troubles making me see this. The Spirit is making me see that your life is but a vapor. It's here and it's gone. In fact, David qualifies. Every man in his best state is but a vapor. Do you think yourself young now with a long life ahead? You don't know. Your life is a vapor. Do you see yourself in the prime of life feeling that you couldn't possibly be stronger or healthier than you are now? Your life, in its best state, is but a vapor. Do you see yourself approaching the end and coming to the revelation that I've already spent half a century on this planet, but my life is a vapor? You do not know the measure of your days. Ben Fisher didn't have as many handbreadths as others. Mr. Meisner had more. But neither of them knew the end of their days. David has come to a profound revelation that while he is suffering here, while he is enduring great difficulty in life, that his life in the big scheme of things isn't going to amount for much. And he adds that Selah that we find so often in Scripture as a helpful pause to let those truths sink in. And let me ask you, do you believe that your life can be characterized as a handbreadth? Do you believe that your age is as nothing? Do you see yourself as vapor? In verse 6, he says, "Surely every man walks about like a shadow. Surely they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches and does not know who will gather them." Surely and surely, he wants us to understand this emphasis he's placed here. David is reflecting again on another aspect of mankind as a whole. And he describes the life of man as walking about like a shadow. Like a shadow. Now, I'm real. And if we were standing outside or under a bright light in some direction, you'd see a shadow. But nobody would confuse me for the shadow, right? I mean, it's kind of funny in a sense when someone gets spooked by a shadow. I think it's funny when a dog gets spooked by a shadow. They don't realize it's nothing there. And the idea that David's conveying is, well, not trying to use the idea of ghost in a modern sense, but that there's a ghost. It's an emptiness. It's a void. It's a shadow. Surely every man walks about like a shadow. And what do the shadows do? Oh, they're busy. Oh, they're busy shadows. They busy themselves doing what? Nothing. Nothing. They're just busy. When you ask them what they're doing, well, they're heaping up riches. They're trying to be as useful to get as much as they can out of life. But David says they don't know what's going to happen. They don't know what the end is in mind. Spurgeon describes these people as they are shadows pursuing shadows while death pursues them. They are shadows pursuing shadows while death pursues them. These shadows work hard. They work hard to pursue something, and they have no idea what it is. Riches, fame, fortune, notoriety. They don't even know who will get it when it's over. And in verse 7, we see David coming to another profound revelation. He says, "And now, Lord, what do I wait for? My hope is in you. Deliver me from all my transgressions, and do not make me the reproach of the foolish." What is my end? That was his prayer when he opened. Make me to know the end. Make me to know what's going to happen. And he says, "I know what my end is. You are my end. My hope is in you. My hope is in Jehovah, and that he will forgive my sins. Deliver me from all my transgressions." David knows that if his life is a vapor, the end must be near in some respect. He does not know when his distress will be gone, but he does know that at the end there awaits for him a judgment declaring him to be clean, declaring him to be righteous. And his reflection is made to point on the great end. No longer is he concerned merely with the wicked who are before him, but now he's considering the end of his days. And he says, "Lord, my hope is in you. Deliver me from all of my sins. I know I've been complaining a lot because it hurts, but I really want to know and understand your forgiveness." You see, the troubles for David are not gone. And he has more to say about the troubles. But David has just now realized that sins are a lot worse than troubles. Troubles are bad, but sins are a whole lot worse than troubles will ever be. David keeps his perspective. Actually, he gains this perspective during this time of prayer. And what he's saying is, if I had to endure troubles or sins, Lord, I'll take troubles any day. Forgive me of my sins. The troubles aren't pleasant, but what awaits sins is a whole lot worse. In verse 9, he says, I was mute, I did not open my mouth, because it was you who did it. I didn't find this particular translation to be that helpful. And in fact, I found Spurgeon has a translation which put this in a better light to help me understand. He describes it as saying, I am silenced, I will not open my mouth. And the idea behind it is that David is not merely repeating the same effort he put forth at the beginning of the psalm. At the beginning he was saying, what? I will guard my ways. I will muzzle my mouth. I was mute with silence. That was self-imposed. But here, David's saying, I was silenced because I met the Almighty. I was silenced because there was nothing to say. I was silenced because God made me have perspective that He is so much bigger than I am. Because I am vapor and I am nothing. You see, what David has now received is the perspective that quiets him on the inside. And that's what he was lacking up front. He was successful at being quiet on the outside, but it was only after meeting Jehovah and gaining perspective that he was quiet on the inside. And now he can say, I was silenced. Because God met with me. You did it. David points his finger right at God and said, you were the one to do this. He doesn't hold back. He doesn't try to say, well, there are these secondary causes and other effects which are to blame. Well, surely the wicked have some responsibility. Well, of course they do. And they'll answer to God for what they've done that's wrong. They'll answer. They won't be delivered from all their transgressions, and on that great day of judgment, they will pay for their sins. But David sees right through those circumstances, and he sees that God is the one who's orchestrated all of these events. He still has no answer as to why. He still has no answer for how long. But he does know who is behind the difficulties in his life. And he takes great comfort in this. And his soul is now quiet. Because he met with the covenant-keeping Jehovah. He met with his loving Father, who by the power of the Spirit came and settled him on the inside and said, I am God Almighty. You do not understand what I'm doing, but that's okay. I do understand it. You see, you don't have to know how long something is going to continue, and you don't have to know why something is happening in your life. The beautiful and the succinct revelation that David receives here is that you can be quiet on the inside and quiet on the outside, that you can have the turmoil settled in your life. You can live your life without murmuring and without complaint, because you see, it is God's hand in ordering your affairs. However big those troubles are, however much of a nuisance they are, however much they irritate you or frustrate you, know that it is your loving Father in heaven who is orchestrating these things. If you find yourself repeatedly banging your head against the wall, asking, how long, O Lord, is this going to continue? Why? Why me? Why are they allowed to escape? Why are they allowed to have this happen? You're asking the wrong questions. You should instead be asking, Lord, help me to see your hand in all of these things so that your soul can be quiet. In verse 10, remove your plague from me. I am consumed by the blow of your hand. When with rebukes you correct man for iniquity, you make his beauty melt away like a moth. Surely every man is vapor. Selah. David's quiet, but yet praying. The wicked have not left him. His troubles are not gone. And now he returns to God in a new frame of mind to continue his prayer that God would remove this difficulty from his life. He's much quieter. He's much calmer. That pot, that cauldron is not boiling over. The lid's not rattling on the stovetop. No, David is in a refreshed frame of mind. And what is he doing? But being drawn to God in prayer. Being drawn to him to come to Jehovah. Why does he do this? After all, if God's in charge, if God's bringing all these things into his life, why bother to pray? Because it's a good thing to draw near to God and ask him to remove these things from our life. Chastisements, they hurt. Correction, it's painful. Discipline, it's unpleasant. There's nothing wrong with asking God to remove these things. David describes the toll it's taking on his body and on his mind, on his soul, as moth-eaten. And I was thinking about this and wondering, who uses mothballs anymore? This is one of those analogies that might not quite resonate with people today as it once did, but how many people have lost a garment to a moth? Yeah, just a few, and they're all over 40, I think. I don't think anybody younger has lost a garment to a moth. But you see, in the old days, even in David's days, up till say 1979, people ran a real risk of losing their garments to moths. And when you put a sweater away, you might have to put some mothballs in the container to keep the critters from eating away slowly. And the idea here is that these moths just eat away until finally the garment or the fabric is not fit for anything anymore. And David sees the terrible toll this is taking on his life, and he's asking God, relieve me from my distress. Take the plague far from me. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner, as all my fathers were. Remove your gaze from me that I may regain strength before I go away and I am no more. What David is concluding in this prayer that I think is very important for us to see is how heartfelt and genuine it is in his need to come before God. He is no longer seeing God as aloof and distant, but someone who cares and will hear him when he prays in earnest. You see, David has moved from a boiling pot to someone who is praying, who is crying, who is offering tears. And he understands that with his relationship with Jehovah, Jehovah will be moved when his people come to him with their prayers, with cries, and with tears. When we think about the why and the how long, which we never seem to get answers for, but is second nature to us, we might not like the result it brings. Why were the wicked prevailing against David? I don't know. David doesn't know, and he doesn't tell us. Perhaps we should more comfortably adopt the posture and the advice given by Aslan when someone would inquire about the welfare of someone else, and he would simply say, "That's not your story." I don't know why David endured what he did, but I do know that the outcome of that difficulty, in part, was that David drew near to God. And so whatever else God might have set about to accomplish in David's life or in the lives of others, in whatever state David found himself in, I do know that one of the accomplished byproducts of the difficulties that God brought to his life was that David was now calm. He had perspective, and he drew near to God. Isn't that worthwhile? Isn't that an end or a hope or a goal that all of us want, is to draw near to our Father in heaven, to cry out to him? And yet there are so many times when our hearts feel distant from him. Sometimes the troubles we face might only have one purpose. That's to get us to reflect and to submit ourselves and come to God. What is the point of a psalm like this? I think the point is to help us to learn to see Jehovah's gaze over our whole life and to draw near to him and to learn that drawing near to him is important. So that this might be accomplished to this end, let me give you just a few very short things to think about. Forsake trying to understand the why of your circumstances. Stop. You're not going to know why God has done what he's done. He's not going to tell you, and in all likelihood, you wouldn't understand. Stop. Contemplate the end of your days. Contemplate the length of your life. How long is it? Remember that imagery of the handbreadth. Remember the vapors. Those are the images that David wants us to have embedded. Contemplate the judgment that awaits all men. Do you find yourself rejoicing that your sins are forgiven? Well, remember, great judgment awaits the wicked. And finally, learn to submit to God's will. If God has brought these difficulties in your life, submit. Not by outwardly muzzling yourself, though there is a place for that, but by inwardly quieting yourself as you rest in God's provision, his protection, and his providence over your whole life. Let's pray.